Gone for us. Everyone here is so calm, so collected, not fiending for a high, but rather pleasantly waiting to commune with nature. Fernando, how many should I eat? I ask. This is my first time, and I'm generally very sensitive to stuff. Just eat three little ones for now. Weston, proud and protective of me, chimes in. You'll be fine. We'll be all right here. This is the best place in the world to do this. The best. Eat them soon, while the light is still out. You'll want to look around and enjoy the view. I eat them, chomp, all at once. They'll taste pretty disgusting, Weston says after I've stuffed them into my mouth. But they don't. They are gummy, the normal texture of a mushroom, but they don't have much taste at all. I wash them down with some water. I wait. I drink some more water. I sit in the grass and chat with the others. I have a few false starts. Ooh, I'm feeling it. Just kidding. No, I'm not. Okay, now I am. Nope, that's an ant on my ankle. Weston floats up to me, maybe feeling it and smiling. Do you hear the world yet? He seems cartoonish to me. Listen to Weston trying to make everything so mystical, I say, mockingly. I get a laugh out of a couple of the other campers. Weston doesn't laugh. But everything is mystical, he says emphatically. He looks at me like I have hurt him. He slinks away. I don't really register it. I'm laughing about something with my new friends. I pull out my journal because I think it would be fun to write down what I'm feeling as it's happening. Then, I feel it. A widening, a tingly slowdown of color and light. I hear sounds as if I were a wolf. Sounds are isolated, far-off sounds, and feel very close. I don't feel drunk or high. This is different. I don't feel dumb or slow. I feel like myself, just heightened. I feel what Weston had told me about, that nature would take on special holiness. I feel an intense love of it all. I pull out my pen and start to write. I want to push my face into the mountain, not the one I'm on, the one far across the Paradise Valley that I could never reach. But the birds see it, and every mountaintop is just another stone poking out of the stream, hopping across. The birds have so much to say. I put my journal down and look around. The 10 of us are sitting around in the grass near one another. Everything is hilarious. My cheeks hurt from laughter. 20 feet away, I hear a ladybug land on a blade of grass. I squint to see it. I see it. I think I see it. I hear her wings flap and then stop, and the mechanics of her red and black shell close over her wings. I hear everything. In the calmness of one phase of my mushroom trip, I sit and watch Weston from afar. He looks so happy, grinning like the Cheshire Cat, inaudibly chatting and using his hands to tell a grand story. I think about his quest for answers, his fluctuations from atheism to Christianity to humanism to nihilism to animism. I think about how badly he wants the world to make sense, how it tears him up, so he tears through ideologies, testing them with all his might. As the mushroom magic courses through my brain, I suddenly understand why he loves experiences like these. For a few hours, the world makes sense. Everything has meaning. Everything is alive in perfect friendship with everything else. I want, in this moment, for Weston to have peace in his heart. I want him to feel what I feel all the time. Total conviction that it all means something, and it all is meant for good. I hear another bug land on a leaf, and my mind goes elsewhere. The sun goes down, and the Argentines start cooking. The food is an assortment of sausages and purple potatoes and onions and other things. Our headlamps create a little micro-world of light in the darkness. At one point, during a rare lull in the giggling, someone sits up, spooked. Did you hear that? Something is over there. We turn our lights to the field and see a semicircle of eyes. No, a full circle, all the way around us. 15 pairs of eyes glowing back from the darkness. Dogs, wild dogs, have surrounded our camp, waiting for us to make a mistake. Fernando is calm. It's just dogs. We'll just need to be careful to pack up our food and put it in the tent with us. We go back to our food and are laughing. Every few minutes, I turn my headlamp behind me, and the eyes are there. waiting. Weston gets up and scares some away. We find it all very funny. But I have waves of dread, looking behind me at the patient beasts. We eat, pack up, and go to bed. We are careful to wrap up all the leftover meat and put it in bags and bring it inside the 10-person tent. We make pallets and get in our sleeping bags. One of the guys does a last runabout screaming session to get the dogs away. They run into the dark. We zip up and fall asleep. I woke up to bright morning light and the front door being unzipped. Then a gasp. They got the meat! I sat up. We'd left the meat outside? No, we'd brought it in with us. But where the meat had been, there was now nothing. In the corner of the tent, a perfect hole. Somehow, the dogs had pulled an Ocean's 11 heist, chewing through the tent, stealing the meat, and eating every last morsel without one of us waking up. Outside the tent, plastic was strewn all over the hillside. We were so amazed, cleaning up the plastic wasn't even annoying. We were too impressed. I expected a hangover or something, but felt nothing. In fact, I felt excellent. Weston was so proud. You see, there's no hangover. It's natural. It's a gift from nature. You enjoyed it? I really did. Chapter 13. God on the Trail. Medellin to Salento. 7,689 miles to go. In the morning, we packed up, joking about scary dogs, and headed back to Medellin and the hostel. I kept thinking, I did mushrooms in Colombia, who am I? The next day, we said our goodbyes and biked into the green mountains beyond Medellin toward a town called La Dorada, 150 miles away, and beyond that, Bogota. One night, we camped in a dark thicket of vines and trees, so thick that it wasn't until morning that we noticed we'd camped only meters away from a house. The next night, we camped under the highway below a bridge. We wanted to be under the bridge itself, but no trees grew under the bridge, so we hung our hammocks on trees that lunged over the river. Unfortunately, the plan was more picturesque than practical. It turned out to be very difficult to get into our hammocks and impossible to get out during the night to pee. It rained harder than any rain I've ever seen in my life that night. The humidity that enveloped us felt so thick that I thought I could bite the air. The rain broke my rain cover and filled my hammock with water. Sleep never came. The next night, tired and hot as hell, we slept in a forest on the side of a hill. After that, the highway dropped from the jungle into a long agricultural valley that cooked us at temperatures over 100. And not the dry heat of Baja, crushing humidity, black clouds of smoke from trucks passing by, and beating sun. By 11 a.m., Weston had run out of water. He pulled over on the side of the road. I'm lightheaded. You want some of my water? I said. This is scary. I'm sweating too much. I'm dizzy, he said, the seriousness in his voice unsettling. I was hot as well, but not dizzy. I have water, I said. We can stop at the next gas station. Hopefully one comes up soon. I don't know if I can bike in this heat. I may need to hitchhike or bus. I stood there, cooking in the sun, and checked the map on my phone. La Dorada is coming up in 20 miles. Let's make it there, spend the night, and we can find a bus to Bogota. I just don't want to pass out. Dang, this is freaky. It sneaks up on you, he said. A miserable hour later, we rolled into La Dorada, a mid-sized town built along a river and bustling with motorbike taxis. We found a janky little motel with air conditioning and sat in our cold room for the rest of the afternoon. I found a bus that would take us to Bogota in the morning. I got on Warm Showers, the app that connects cyclists with free places to stay, and found a guy who'd host us in Bogota. We messaged and he said he'd meet us at the bus station and take us to his house. Weston was shaken by how dehydrated and hot he had become. The next day, we bussed up more mountains and through thick forest to enter the giant metropolis of Bogota. Like Medellin, Bogota is another ocean of red brick. But instead of being wedged into a narrow valley, Bogota stretches out across a high plain. A steep mountain rises next to the downtown area with a gondola to the top. The air is thick with smog. Cars and people are everywhere. Houses are jammed together like townhomes covered in red brick and stucco and chipped paint. Power lines tangle above the streets like black knots of hair. Every intersection is a sea of mopeds and bicycles. The city sits at 8,600 feet, and the thin air and proximity to the equator make for sharp, piercing heat in the afternoons and nights as cold as ice. At the bus station, we waited by the entrance for our warm showers host. A teenager walked his bicycle up to the door and introduced himself. "Hi, I'm Luis." He was probably 16. Weston and I smiled at each other and hopped on our bikes, and he led us through the city for an hour to his house. A brick sliver of a house behind heavy metal gates. He unlocked what must have been 10 different locks to get us in. Inside the humble house, we met his mother, who looked very surprised to see us. Clearly, Luis hadn't told his mom that two large gringos would be invading her home. She seemed pretty uncomfortable the whole night, and as she cooked us dinner, she was ready at any moment for us to rob or attack her. Weston sat on his phone, flicking his thumb across the screen. He found a girl on Tinder that said she would host us for a night. "Your Tinder girl is going to accept two guys?" I asked. "Yeah, she seems amazing. She wants to show us around." "I thought Tinder was for sex," I said. "It's also a way for great people to meet each other. This is going to be great. And maybe she'll be into me," he said with a wink. Mariana showed up the next morning with a small red car and a Bernese mountain dog named Copernico. She was tall, with long, straight brown hair. She had a severe but pretty face and spoke perfect English. She was talkative right off the bat and addressed us like old friends. No niceties. "Get in. I have several places to show you before we do dinner." Mariana seemed able to answer every question. Even if she didn't know the exact answer, she could say something that felt like an answer. As we drove around and her dog licked my face and slobbered everywhere, she answered my questions about the Colombian economy, the government, the history, the treatment of natives. She told us she was from a well-to-do family and had studied political science. "Sometimes my grandmother says I look native," she said, "which is her trying to insult me. To look native is bad, dark skin, short. That is her generation. They are very racist." "See all those nice cars?" she said at one point. "All these big trucks? Colombia is trying to be America. They want new and nice things, and they buy it on credit. It's all on credit. No one can afford this stuff. It's all going to crash." We stayed at her apartment that night. Weston slept with her in her bed, and I slept in a hammock hanging in the corner. While they made out, I fell asleep, thinking about how smart she was and how glad I was to meet her. Her place was pretty small, so she suggested a hostel for us to move into the next morning. But she made it known that she would like to show us more of Bogota while we were there. The hostel was a lovely old house with a big gate and a bloodhound living in the courtyard. The cheapest room had 15 bunks, but Bogota was expensive, so it was our only option. That, or miraculously find more Tinder girls. I found out that a bunk room full of backpackers will punish you all night with snoring of incredible volume. No doubt the altitude and the smog weren't helping, but some of these backpackers must have developed brain damage from the choke snoring they were doing. I lay awake for two nights, waiting for one or two to die. We hung out with Mariana all week. She would tell us exactly when she would pick us up and where we were going. She was always in control. She took us to breweries, steakhouses, coffee shops, museums, and even a cathedral and a salt mine. Weston thought she was only sticking around because of me. "She doesn't even really talk to me," he said. "She's my Colombian girlfriend," I said with pride. Weston clocked the beautiful girl working the front desk of our hostel. She was short, with a Selma Hayek vibe and long, beautiful dark hair. Her accent was Colombian raspy perfection. He turned on the charm, and they went to dinner. He reported that they had raucous sex at a cheesy sex hotel. Apparently these hotels exist because people live with their families till they're married, so they need places to bang. He said the television was on and it was The Simpsons turned up really loud. He said she was equally loud. He said she might have broken his dick. He said she had changed him. She did this ball-slapping thing. I'm a changed man. During a FaceTime with my mom, she tried out an idea. Jed, what do you think of me coming down for Easter? I have a lot of airline points from my Costco credit card. What if your brother and Anna and I come down for Easter? I'll rent a house. Where could we meet you? The thought of seeing family again was a welcome thing, but at her offer, I noticed that my homesickness had lessened. I wasn't desperate to escape the road anymore. My dad was right. The road had become my life now. I am a nomad, I thought. I am comfortable in this homelessness, this at-homeness on the road. A plan occurred to me. I told my mom. Well, if we time it right, we'll be in Quito, Ecuador by Easter. That's in 1 month. Why don't you check tickets and rent a little Airbnb down there, and we can do Easter there? Ooh, Ecuador, my mom said with a playful Spanish accent. That sounds beautiful. I'll do some research and let you know. This will be an adventure. 20 minutes later, I got an email from her with her Airbnb receipt and flight itinerary. She had rented an apartment in Quito for a few nights around Easter Sunday and then a house on the beach. My brother and sister-in-law would come too. I was excited, though stressed about making it to Quito on time. To be in Quito by Easter, we would need to travel 1,100 kilometers in just a few weeks. Uh-oh, that would be a race. We said goodbyes to Mariana and Copernico and cycled out of the city. It took us a whole day just to get out of Bogota. Camping at such elevations was cold and difficult, and we tried to stay in hostels and hotels when we could. The two-lane mountain roads were crowded with semi-trucks and massive buses. Several people had told us we had to stop in Salento, a coffee-growing village in the mountains famous for its attractive buildings and surroundings. We didn't really have time to stop, but I got mad at having a schedule and racing to Quito, so we rerouted our course for Salento. After several days of biking, we arrived at the beautiful little town, loved it immediately, and ended up staying there for 4 days. Green mountains surrounded the town, and a picturesque river wound through the valley below. It is how I would imagine Switzerland if it had been near the equator. The high elevation and the weather, a mix of chilly and warm, made the region perfect for coffee. Our hostel was tucked into an old Spanish building with high-ceilinged rooms. The owner was an American, a geologist with gray hair and turquoise beads around her neck. She had come down to study the volcano near Salento years ago and fallen in love with the place. A messy breakup and perhaps a midlife crisis had brought her back. She said that the volcano nearby was due to blow at any time. She said the last time it blew, more than 1,000 people died. She said this with the indignation of scientists in sci-fi movies when they warn of the asteroid or alien invasion and the world doesn't take them seriously. Weston and I liked her right away. She recommended a hike in the Cocora Valley. The scenery is stunning, waterfalls and cliffs and a cafe at the end where you can get a beer. The valley, part of Los Nevados National Natural Park, also features the national tree, the Quindío wax palm. She pointed one out down the road, and Weston and I recognized it. We'd seen a bunch of them on the roads. It looks like a typical palm tree, but taller, as if Dr. Seuss had given it a cartoonish stretch. In the morning, we enjoyed our free coffee and pastry, then caught a shuttle bus to the trailhead, where the valley closed off into a box canyon, and the river came cascading out of thick forest. Our trail crisscrossed the river with exotic-looking wooden rope bridges. I don't know if this valley had a special spirit about it or if Weston and I hadn't had a real check-in in a while, but we got to talking about more than our usual surface observations. Jed, I have a question, he said.
Yes?
Do you believe in Jesus, like for real? I laughed at the bigness of the question. He smiled in the asking, knowing that it was almost absurd to ask something like that outright. Do I believe he existed? Yes, I said. Do you believe he is the Son of God, the actual Son of God, to wipe away the sins of humanity. I was quiet for a beat, thinking harder now. I don't know. I had never been asked that point blank, and my once intact certainty had been eroding for several years. I tried to convey what I thought now. Yes, in a way, I said. I mean, I believe in his teachings and his life and his message saving us from our sins. You do? Do you actually believe he rose from the dead? Like, for real, did he miraculously rise from the dead? Weston's pointedness rattled me. I had spent so many years in church not actually being asked. He was like a reverse inquisitor, demanding statements of unfaith. Well, I think so, I said. You think so? Doesn't it all come down to that? Like, all of Christianity rides on this miracle. If he died for your sins and didn't rise, then was he really God? And what does it all mean? His questions weren't antagonistic or charged. He was just looking down, hiking, stepping over rocks, thinking out loud and asking me questions. You know, the masculine way of having vulnerable conversations. A shared journey, no eye contact, both looking ahead, seemingly uninterested in the answers. I don't know, I said. Do you believe in sin? Yeah, yes. Okay, what is sin? It's doing things that separate you from God, like choosing yourself over God, thinking you know better than he does. And how can anything separate us from God? He made everything, right? What's not his? Isn't he everywhere? Yeah, but he gave us free will, or some version of it. You really believe in free will? Yeah, I said, without hesitation. I know it's a weird concept, but how else would we be in relationship with God? Without a choice, we'd be robots. So sin is what again? When we choose to do things our way, and not God's way, I guess. But wouldn't an all-knowing God forgive us those things, like correct us, show us a better way? I guess that's what Jesus did, isn't it? Yeah, but do you really believe he had to be tortured and murdered and sacrificed to make up for a game that his father invented? One that he knew all the players would lose? I couldn't tell if Weston was on a quest to understand himself or simply to challenge me. But he was thinking about something other than his body, his steps, and his breathing. He had slowed his pace. I had too, walking just a few steps behind. We kept on like that for a while, him peppering me with questions, me regurgitating what I'd heard and read over years of church and Bible studies, at once agreeing with what I was saying, wondering if I really believed it, and hearing how ridiculous it sounded when I said it out loud. Weston's mind was moving fast, his words starting and stopping, unfinished thoughts leapfrogging their way to other thoughts. All the while, though we barely noticed, we were climbing higher, along and over the cascading creek. So you're telling me you really think this was the best idea God had for us, to build the universe in such a way that we show up with a deadly handicap that will doom us, 100%, unless we learn a story about his son and say his name and understand the story of how it happened? That was God's best idea? That was the thing I could finally not overcome, and why I walked away. It didn't make sense. Weston was beside me now, looking at me when he talked. We had crossed the creek several times, and almost ignored the beauty of it all, our heads swimming in the meaning of life. God is so much bigger than us, it doesn't always have to make sense, I said, falling back on the time-worn justification. Jed, you're a smart guy, Weston said, but I don't think you're supposed to be a Christian. I recoiled with a surprised laugh. I think you're really just a kind guy trapped in a tradition, he continued. You're gay and you're out, and free, but you were raised a certain way, and you won't let go of it. You don't want to spin through space without a tether. I remember when I was a Jesus freak, I was preaching from park benches and screaming the gospel. Salvation of souls was an emergency. I don't see that in your eyes. I see a guy who likes the idea of God, of love, of defending a faith system that is the norm and the majority, but pretends it's a victim and the underdog. If you really thought about it all, you would realize that the Jesus story is too small for God, if God exists. I remember reading somewhere that when people argue, their brains seize up and lose the ability to take in new information. But this wasn't exactly an argument. Yes, I was recalling defenses and thoughts, but I was also listening. Well, I said, I don't pretend to have all the answers. I just know that God, if you zoom out a bit, doesn't have to be so small. I agree with you on this, Weston. I'm just not ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It feels untrue to do that. It feels like you're trying to convince me not to be a Christian. I don't need you to do that. Here we were, walking through one of the most beautiful places on the planet, with giant mountains surrounding us. And the two of us were looking at the ground, our minds somewhere else, lost in our histories and cosmologies. You say the universe is patient with us, I said after a brief silence, that the universe put magic in mushrooms and whatever. But aren't you just talking about God with another name? Aren't you just personifying it the same way Christians do? Well, sure, yeah, I guess that's right. But I don't think that the universe loves me. And calling it the universe leaves it open to mystery and implies how big and unknowable it is. You think we're the same as animals? I said, trying to cover all angles. Yes, why wouldn't we be? Because we have consciousness. We have a soul. God made us in his image. Jed, what does that mean? We'd hiked a long way. I could see the cafe in the distance, surrounded by trees and steep cliffs high above. I looked up for a minute and felt the strange juxtaposition of incredible beauty and the fact that Weston and I had hardly acknowledged it. I broke the flow for a minute. Weston, look around. Holy shit, we're so deep in our dismantling of the patriarchy and religion that we're missing this. He laughed and brought it back. Are you kidding? I've been seeing it all. What better place to destroy God than surrounded by his best handiwork? Or what better place to replace the white man's God with the God of nature? He capped off his pronouncement with a few fist pumps in the air. But we jumped right back in. Paul says that the gospel is a mystery, I said. Look at Job, at Ecclesiastes. I think the Bible is teaching us how to think about God. It's a journey of understanding. It starts with a very human-like God, because we were so primitive in the beginning, and as we advanced, so did our understanding of God, which reached its high point in Jesus. That's why God sent his son there, because we could understand him. Maybe so, but that was 2,000 years ago. Why would our understanding of God have frozen 2,000 years ago? All these pastors talking about what the Bible really means, they're trying to make this ancient document relevant. It's retarded. Don't say retarded. Sorry. It's ridiculous. As we learn about the universe and God, we realize that he isn't a he or human at all, but the universe itself. It isn't human-like at all. This is the next step. Religious people are just stuck in a feedback loop of old information. You think I'm stupid for still calling myself a Christian? I asked. No. You think I don't? I think you're a coward. Whoa, I said. Weston realized how intense and heavy it sounded. Okay, listen. You want me to tell you what I really think? And here I was, thinking you were just high all the time, I said jokingly. Yes, go ahead. What I mean by coward is that, Jed, I think you know that your beliefs are old and archaic and meaningless in the modern world. I think you know that, and have reasoned and rationalized faith so you don't have to be controversial, don't have to upset your family or your mom or whatever. I think your sexuality caused you to go extra on your faith to be a good boy. You'd be a super Christian in order to overcompensate. You'd prove that being gay wasn't perverted. You'd prove it was reasonable and something good boys do. I think you're wearing the costume, hiding from something you know is true. I think that you're scared, and that's bullshit. I just want you to be free. I realized then, after traveling down half the globe with him, that he had been analyzing me as much as I had him. Perhaps seeking safety, I tried to pivot. Free, like you, chasing one high to the next? I asked, surprised by my response. I don't expect you to understand. I've been where you are, dude. Well, I'm not gay, but in every other way I know. I know what it's like to want to be good, to want to be a good boy and a good son, and think that God loves me because my teachers love me and my friends' parents trust me. You don't love God, man. You love feeling like you belong to something. That warm feeling of order in the universe, of having the universe on your side, but really having people on your side. I just want you to be free from all that shit. I hear you. I hear you. I know you do. And I love you for that. I'm just figuring it all out. I feel like some days I'm arguing for God, and another day I'm arguing against him. I wish I liked weed and it didn't make me puke in my underwear. We both laughed. Weston was visibly relieved to see me playful and not offended. My mind was busily weighing all that had been said, wondering what scaffolding inside me had been knocked away. I thought about Weston's worldliness, his rugged edges, his impurity. He carried a cloak of wisdom covered in dirt. We reached the base of the stairs to the cafe above. It was a wooden cabin with a large wraparound porch and several hikers enjoying coffee, looking back at the trail. Something buzzed past my head. We both got wide-eyed and looked around us. We were surrounded by hummingbirds. 50. Maybe 100. A species I'd never seen in my life, with long, hooked, and split tails, like two opposite-facing jays hanging behind them. They were everywhere, shining purple and black and blue like an oil spot in a heavenly parking lot. We came out of our spiritual stupor, our high-octane conversation, surrounded by fairies swirling around us. The forest had taken on that other layer. It was beautiful, the air was clean, the light angled just right. I was wondering what it meant to be a Christian. I wondered if I was going to heaven, if Weston was. I saw the other hikers sipping coffee and speaking various languages. I saw them as eternal souls, each one destined for something. For relationship with God or rejection of God. Or nothing at all, just death and worms and eternal sleep. We got coffee, and I talked about the hummingbirds to think about something else. My mind turned them into a sign from the Holy Spirit that God was with me. I didn't say that to Weston. Chapter 14. Sex hotels, and here comes Mom. Cali to Quito. 7,111 miles to go. Our conversation rattled me, though I didn't show it. Instead, in a move perfected by most men, Weston and I moved right into joking around and didn't speak about God or sin again, outside of the occasional, "the universe made me do that, huh?" joke. On the hike back to the bus, I barely said anything. My mind felt twisted like a wrung-out washcloth, my theology bludgeoned and embarrassed. We stayed one more night in Salento before heading south to Cali. Nicely paved highways and medium-sized towns and a comfortable ride. Farms and fruit stands and stray dogs. We arrived in Cali as the sun was setting on the second day. En route, I hadn't been able to find Wi-Fi, so we hadn't lined up lodging. We approached a cab driver who was leaning on his cab smoking a cigarette and asked for advice. He lit up and told us we could walk our bikes to a hostel nearby. The Hollywood Hotel was adorned with a painting of Marilyn Monroe on the wall. That should have been a clue, because it ended up being a sex hotel. Weston and I shared a queen bed with a mirror above it, and the wall rattled with the sounds of people having sex in the next room, or perhaps in all the rooms. We laughed ourselves to sleep. We didn't like the feel of Cali, probably because of the grime of the hotel, so we didn't hang around. Besides, we needed to get to Quito to meet up with my family. Over the next few days, we pressed on to the border of Ecuador and Colombia, to a town called Ipiales. By then, the Andes had begun. The mountains were still green, but showed snow in the distance. Deciduous forests gave way to green grass and shrubs and evergreen trees in the narrow places where mountains meet. Ipiales was small and pretty clearly built for tourism. People came from all over to see the nearby Basilica of Las Lajas Sanctuary, jutting out into a narrow canyon over the Guaitara River. It hangs in the sky like something out of Lord of the Rings, white, comically ornate, and built on top of giant stone arches over the canyon and river below. The jagged white spires make it look like the lower jaw of a dragon or a dangerous wedding cake. We walked to an overlook spot where I gave Weston my camera to take my photo. As he stood back, a group of 30 Colombian teenagers walked up behind us. They were giggling, and it was clear they were talking about us. One of the braver ones interrupted and asked, "Gringo, are you from America?" "Yes," Weston said. "Can we photo with you?" "Oh, sure," Weston said. Suddenly, the teenagers lined up, and their chaperone began taking photos of them with us. I thought it would be a group photo, but each kid wanted their own, and then each kid wanted their own and one with their two best friends. For 30 minutes, we were celebrities. "What was that?" Weston said, laughing once they'd left. "It keeps happening." "I've been thinking about it." "I bet you have a theory." "Of course I do," I said. "They watch a lot of American television and movies, right? Full of white people." "Yes, definitely. But there aren't a ton of white people around here. On the back roads we're on, I mean." "That's probably true," he said. "So they've seen white Americans in all these movies and all these TV shows, and so the concept of a white person is, like, famous to them. They've been staring at people like us their whole lives and only seen a handful up close. Like, think about a Maasai warrior. Have you ever met one?" "No," he laughed. "But you know who they are and what they look like." "Of course, they're famous." "And if you saw one at your local mall, you'd look at your friend and say, 'Oh my God, a Maasai warrior in our mall,' and then maybe ask for a photo." Weston gave me a head nod. "It's not the worst theory I've heard," he said. Back in Ipiales, we walked uphill by the cathedral and passed a row of touristy trinkets and guinea pigs on rotisserie spinners. They looked like skinned rats glistening with glaze over a fire. I had heard that guinea pigs, cuy, were native to the Andes and had been a major source of protein before the Spanish brought over chickens, cows, pigs, and goats. Now they were eaten at special occasions, for sacred holidays and so on. They'd been domesticated thousands of years ago, so long ago, in fact, that there's now no such thing as a wild guinea pig. But this was the first time I'd seen these cute pets roasting on the sidewalk. Little furry sacred creatures, for sale to tourists. Speaking of sacred, it was April, almost Easter. That meant mom time was almost here. My mom, brother, and sister-in-law were due in Quito in 2 days. We had to get there quick. It was 155 miles away. That would have been doable on flat land, but from Cali, we had crawled up to 9,000 feet elevation, and with these winding mountain roads, We didn't think we could make it more than 40 miles a day. We walked our bikes across the border, got our stamp out of Colombia and into Ecuador. From there, we decided to bike for a day, then bus or hitchhike the last bit. As we entered Ecuador, the land felt different. For the first time, we were truly in the Andes. The trees grew only in clumps of dark green evergreens on the mountainsides. The light was sharp, the air thin. We'd grown accustomed to wide swings in temperature, but up here, it was worse. If the sun was out, we'd bake. By midnight, the puddles had frozen, and the people we passed looked very poor and almost exclusively indigenous, worlds apart from the urban populations of Colombia. The Quechua people of this region date to the Inca Empire. They are short, stocky, darker-skinned, often with sloped noses. They live in small clay houses in the treeless world of high-altitude mountains where they keep sheep. As Weston and I biked past, people would stare at us with sullen expressions. If I stared back, they showed no sign of relenting or caring. Rural Ecuadorian women wear felt bowler hats, the ones you've seen in old photos of British businessmen or that famous painting of the guy in the bowler hat with the green apple in front of his face. Those hats. They love them. I kept asking people why, and they didn't know. I found that curious. You live in a country peopled with this interesting culture, and you don't know why they wear their very distinct costume? Then I thought, why do some Native Americans wear suede coats with frills or headdresses? Or why do some black people wear picks in their hair or do-rags? Why do business people wear ties? I have no idea. I've never asked. Eventually, though, I got to the bottom of this bowler hat situation. When British companies were connecting South America through a vast railway system in the early 20th century, the railmen wore them, and the Quechua-speaking people liked them, especially the women, so they adopted them. It was that simple. As is to be expected, after I'd met a few Quechua-speaking people and heard a few locals explain how they live in the Andes, I drew firm and sweeping conclusions. My lazy brain saw the same patterns everywhere. Travel can do that to you. Oh, I've been to Italy. The Italian people are so relaxed, so welcoming. Really? How long were you in Italy? Oh, for 48 wonderful hours. The two-lane highway coiled around the switchbacks where buses geared down to puff enormous clouds of black smoke into our faces. Up a mountain, down into a valley. We made it to the sweet little town of San Gabriel, slept there for a night in a small hotel, woke up early, propped our bikes up and put our thumbs out, hitchhiked to the larger town of Ibarra with a proper bus stop, and took a bus from there to Quito. As the bus crested the final summit, we saw the bowl of human civilization in the valley below, Quito. This was becoming a South American norm. Cities at high elevation built in mountain valleys. It looked much like Bogota and Medellin. Red brick buildings, a few tall condominiums and office buildings, the spires of massive cathedrals piercing the sky, wispy, low clouds hugging the cold mountains. Quito had one main mountain standing right over the city, just like Bogota, and, just like Bogota, a gondola rising to the top, leading to an overlook and visitor center. From the bus station, we tracked down a hostel, where we showered and had beers with some Israelis and Germans. The next day, my mom, my brother Luke, and his wife Anna arrived. The Quito airport was new, all glass, giant TVs, shiny coffee shops, and polished floors. My mom appeared in the crowd at baggage claim, glowing, seeing me from across the room, shooting her hands in the air with a little jig, and then struggling to get her rolly bag to go in a straight line. She was feeling international. Even as her bag was rebelling, she danced and wiggled her hips and made a duck face, all representative of how cool she was, flying to Ecuador. Amid a flurry of hugs, my mom couldn't stop talking about how clean the airport was. We picked up our rental cars, two tiny red ones, and drove to our Airbnb back in the city. "Oh, this is a huge metropolitan city," she exclaimed. "So cosmopolitan, much more advanced than I thought." But she got a headache from the altitude almost immediately and needed to relax on the couch. Meanwhile, we planned out our time in Quito. To begin, we would walk around the old town and take in a nice dinner spot with opera singers in the city center. She was thrilled about the prospect of that. It felt wonderful to be around family. The next day, we set out on foot, and my mom was mesmerized by everything, by the old Spanish buildings, by the high-rise condominiums. Inside the gold-leafed cathedrals, she took 1,000 photos. "The Catholics really know how to build. This looks like Europe," she'd say. Quito seemed glutted with churches and cathedrals. They seemed to be on every block. The largest, the Basilica del Voto, was visible from almost any point in the city, its dark gray and menacing Gothic spires pointing heavenward. We made our way to it, and Weston and I got to the top of the imposing steps first. As we walked into the basilica, two girls greeted us from a table under a massive gilded doorway. $2, one of them said to us.
Perdón, Weston said.
$2 por persona, por favor.
We have to pay to enter a church, he said.
Sí, she said.
Weston spun on his heels to walk away. This perfectly sums it up, he fumed. Jesus is spinning in the grave he never rose from. A place meant for God, for a moment with God, charges money to enter. If that isn't moral bankruptcy, I don't know what is. Back outside, I said to Luke and Anna as they walked up, "We're not going in there. They charge." My mom was taking a photo from the sidewalk. I just said, "It's closed, Mom."
"Oh, okay. I didn't want to walk up all those stairs," she said.
On Good Friday, we positioned ourselves for the parade through the center of town. We figured out the right streets and drove our little rental cars to park and post up. All around us, people had brought chairs and coolers, claiming prime spots. My mom's camera hung around her neck, her fanny pack bursting full of God knows what. As the parade began, so did the wonders winding through the narrow stone streets. Here came dozens of people in purple gowns and purple pointed hoods standing up from their heads.
"Is this a KKK march?" my brother asked in shock.
I had no idea, but a woman standing near us on the crowded street chimed in. "These are Catholic, not like America. It is different," she said, smiling meekly as if to apologize for eavesdropping.
"Oh, thank you. We were concerned," Mom said.
I had come to learn that all over Latin America, I couldn't assume that people around me didn't speak English. I couldn't gossip or giggle with Weston because someone in any cafe, no matter how rural, spoke English. I later researched the pointed hats and robes and learned that criminals were forced to wear the cones in humiliation as they were marched through town and pummeled with rotten fruit and mud. The Spanish Catholics adopted the pointed hat and cloak as a sign of guilt and humility during Easter week and marched through the cities as penance for their sins. The Ku Klux Klan co-opted the hood for reasons unclear, maybe in reference to holiness, maybe to look like scary ghosts to intimidate blacks. It's fitting that those hoods were meant for dunces and sinners. Some of the purple people paraded past with no shirts on, just the coned hoods. Some carried giant wooden crosses so heavy that they had to put them down every few paces. The cross carriers were barefoot, and the pavement was scalding in the sun. A few of the crosses had green plants tied all around them. Other marchers, without crosses, had bundles of the green plants tied with string into a whip, and as they walked, they whipped their bare backs. My mom, worried,
wondered out loud what the plant was. "It is a plant that stings and cuts. It burns. It is very painful," our woman explained. "It is a way for the people to repent of their sin, to feel the pain of sin." As they walked by, I could see their backs were bright red and scratched. The plant looked like the stinging nettle that grows in North America that stings the legs with the slightest contact, like thousands of fire ant bites. Weston couldn't help himself. Religion is so absurd. These people are cutting themselves for something imaginary, made up by Spain, their oppressors. Along came a large group carrying a litter, one of those boxes that a king or queen or Oprah would sit on while people carried them on their shoulders, with a life-size Virgin Mary seated on it. The parade went on a full 3 hours, and by the time we made our way back to the apartment, our sunburns were setting in. But my mom had been affected more deeply. "This is so much more powerful than America. It shames us," she said. "We are so complacent in our faith and our abundance. These people have nothing, and they show their commitment to the Lord like this. They take salvation seriously. We Americans are so comfortable. We think giving up chocolate for Lent is a sacrifice. These poor people are barefoot and bleeding and actually picking up their crosses for Jesus." "Mom, you once told me you didn't think Catholics are saved," I said. "No, I didn't." "Yes, you did." "Well, you must have misunderstood. God is mysterious. True, we Protestants don't believe in a pope, and we may disagree on scripture here and there, and we have different styles of worship, but they are so committed to Christ and salvation, how could God not reward them? Who are we to decide? Besides, the Bible says, whosoever believes will be saved." "Mom, you've told me that scripture is not a buffet. I can't pick and choose what is true." "It isn't." "Well, wouldn't that mean that some Christianity is right and some is wrong?" "Yes, but God judges the heart. And maybe Protestants get some things wrong. I'm sure we do. And Catholics get some things wrong. I know they do. But how can you look at the devotion we just saw and doubt their commitment to Christ?" "I'm just pointing out inconsistency, Mama." "Don't. It's annoying," she said with a grin. My conversations with Weston had me looking at my mom differently. My childhood, my upbringing, taking it all apart, figuring out what was real and what was not. I remember lying in bed, maybe I was 12 years old, waiting for my mom to come sit beside me and say prayers over me, and hearing my sister scream at her from the kitchen. "I hate you. No wonder you can't stay married. Everyone hates you." And then the familiar slam of my sister's door, and my mom coming in, her eyes red from tears she'd wiped away. "Okay, cutie. Ready for bed?" She shut off all but the nightlight so I wouldn't be able to see her face. "Dear Lord, watch over Jed as he dreams. Thank you for all our blessings, for our family, for this house, and the beauty of each day." I lay there, eyes open, watching her talk, watching for a tear, maybe, wondering if God could really hear her. Her eyes were perfectly, effortlessly closed. "Thank you for the hardships that make us strong and make us rely on you, Lord. Amen. Sweet dreams, Jed. What do you want for breakfast tomorrow?" "French toast." "Okay. You got it. Good night." I remember we went to church every Sunday morning, every Sunday night, and every Wednesday night. I would moan and beg not to go. "Mom, it's so boring. I hate it. You're making me hate God." "Well, as long as you live under my roof, you're going to church. Train up a child in the way that he should go and he will not depart from it. That's what I'm doing." I thought, "Oh, I'll depart from it. Watch me." I resented church, and I resented my mom for making me go. Years later, she told me in passing, "I was a single mother of 3 kids, no money, no help, no time to myself. Church was the only safe place we could go where I knew you'd be looked after and taken care of. It was the only place I felt less alone in all of this." As a kid, it never dawned on me that my mother was overwhelmed or frightened or worried about the job she was doing. It never occurred to me that she had complex motives. Quito had my mother sprightly and full of the joy of discovery. She took photos of every stone and doorway. That night, we had booked a fancy dinner at an Italian restaurant on one of the city's picturesque squares. The restaurant, which famously served up an opera performance mid-meal, could have been a palace, with gold chandeliers, enormous paintings and tapestries adorning the walls, marble floor, waiters in red tux jackets and black pants. The place was packed with older people, tourists, and families. We ordered two bottles of wine. Weston and I had put on our best clothes, denim shirts, buttoned up, and blue jeans. My mom wore new jewelry she'd bought from a street vendor. She put on nice lipstick and seemed to glow with self-awareness that she was in another country with her family eating an expensive meal. I could feel her taking in the scene to tell her friends back home. As we had wine and talked about the parade, Luke and Anna were canoodling and being cute. They were always like that, one of those married couples who actually like each other and continue to. She would lean back and giggle at anything he said. He had his hand on her knee, a steady presence. My mom, historically, didn't drink much. I actually had no memory of her drinking when I was a kid. When I had asked her why in my early 20s, she said she didn't like the taste, and that she didn't like drunks, having seen enough of them growing up in the Ozarks. But as her children became adults, she began having wine with us on holidays and margaritas on hot summer nights. I discovered that she was a lightweight. Sitting here dressed in her Sunday best at 8,000 feet elevation in Quito, Ecuador, she was loving her life. She was drinking her wine and laughing deeply. As she drank wine, she got gigglier. I made fun of all her rings and jewelry and the fact that soon she'd be weighed down, dragging her arms like a cartoon caveman. She flashed her many rings. "I look amazing," she said. They were rings of different stones, mostly turquoise and tiger's eye. I told her she was beginning to look like a woman from Sedona. Then the opera started. We were all a bit buzzed and therefore loud, encouraging, and jubilant, clapping and hooting. The song was by a man in a mask and a woman in a big poofy dress. They sang between the tables and were playful with the guests. The man would sing at women eating and flip men's ties and mess up kids' hair. Each table thought it was hilarious and wonderful, and their voices were loud and excellent. My mom was turned around in her chair and clapping along, and just a bit fluid from her wine. Her movements were softer and her smile wider. The man came over and knew she spoke English just from looking at her. "Look at this goddess." "Who, me?" my mom said. She looked at us around the table and her eyes were so bright. "This is a woman, a beautiful woman." He sang and came up behind her, rubbing her shoulders. She raised her shoulders in affirmation and closed her tipsy eyes and smiled ear to ear and cooed. "How can beauty like this be? How is your meal?" "Wonderful," she exclaimed. He told Anna she looked like an angel and made fun of my brother's shirt. Everyone was laughing, but I was looking at my mom. She was watching the opera singer, staring at him like a crushing teenager, hoping he'd come back. I saw her young and beautiful. It crossed my mind that she had maybe not been kissed in 15 years, or longer, since my stepdad divorced her for the secretary. I didn't know. She looked so beautiful, so regal in her womanliness, and yet childlike in her innocence. In that moment, I wanted her to fall in love again. I wanted her to feel as beautiful as she was. The opera singer sauntered to another table. I saw my mom turn back into herself, close her inner doors with a smile. She returned to her wine and turned to me.